When there's a fire or medical emergency, most run the other way. For hundreds of volunteers in our community, it's the exact opposite. This year, Portage Health Foundation is celebrating those volunteers with $50,000 in funding. All volunteer emergency services units in Baraga, Houghton, Keweenaw, or Onondaga County are eligible for this funding with up to $5,000 available per grantee. This grant can be used to fund new turnout gear, make upgrades to vehicles or buildings, and much more. We can't wait to see how this funding will be used to make our community a safer place. Learn more at phfgive.org.
Hard to believe we're coming up on the 109th anniversary of the 1913-1914 copper strike. Good morning, I'm Todd Van Dyke. Welcome to Copper Country Today. Our program is brought to you by the Portage Health Foundation. You can find out more about them at their website, phfgive.org. And even though it's been more than a century since the strike, there are still people doing a lot of research on that time here in the Copper Country and finding out new things and new aspects and new ways to look back at that historic event. I happened to cross paths recently with a young lady named Allie Penn. It was actually somebody shared a Twitter post that she had put up, and it referenced some work that she has been doing, research into this, as a graduate student at Wayne State University. And I contacted her, and we agreed that she would come on the program, and I'm thrilled that she's here. Allie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Allie, you have been working particularly on the aspect and the role of women in the strike.
Yes. I don't know what it is about the women, but whatever I'm researching, whatever project I work on, they always seem to find their way into it, and I just can't look away from them. So I think that this is a really great example of, you know, like you've said, there's so many great, you know, projects and so much great research done on the strike, and I think that the women of the strike are just an area that maybe hasn't gotten the attention it deserves, and I think that that's something I hope to do to, like, help that area.
What drew you to the strike initially, just in general, in the first place?
Sure. So I did my undergrad at Northern Michigan in Marquette. And while there, I worked at the Michigan Iron Industry Museum. And my dissertation project is actually on paternalism in the iron ranges. So I've strayed a little far in this project. But it was the book Death's Door that sort of got me interested in the strike. And I know that people have a lot of feelings about that book. But
yeah, Steve Leto's been on this program several times. He and I are acquainted, and it's exhaustively researched, and it's a wonderful book.
Absolutely. And so it was that book, you know, that started it, and then from there it was easy into Larry Langdon's books, and then just sort of everything, and wanting to know. And I think, like a lot of women, I just was obsessed with Annie Clemenc, and I just wanted to know as much about her. And so it was in researching Annie and, you know, using her biography that Lyndon Comstock wrote that I realized how prominent the women were, especially when you look at the miners' bulletin records. And it was just this, like, constant rabbit hole of, you know, following each little breadcrumb to get to where I'm at today.
Yeah, for the 100th anniversary, I did a look back day by day as what was happening in the strike 100 years previous. And it was something that had struck me at the time as well, the role that women played in the strike. And of course, everybody who knows about the strike knows about Big Annie Clemenc and the leadership role that she played. But there were a lot of roles that were played by other women in this strike, and some rather militant, angry roles. Did you notice that too?
Yeah. So my project is called, digital mapping of the quote, female agitators, unquote, which is actually what the newspaper dubbed the women because of, you know, their militancy and the way they were sort of taking on these aggressively masculine roles of, you know, approaching soldiers and arguing with strike breakers and, you know, ended up in these disputes in the same way that men would have at the time.
And infamously, in some cases, throwing the contents of their chamber pots out on the strike breakers.
I believe that is Mrs. Wydus who was responsible for that. And I love that story of just, you know, how the newspapers, like, tensions just rose to such a degree that she just couldn't help herself. But I also love that example because, you know, she's taking on this very aggressive stance and she does that. But then when she goes to court, you know, she brings her baby and takes on this very, you know, subservient female role of, I'm just a mom with my baby. So the judge, you know, lets her go so long as she doesn't get in trouble again. And I think that that's really interesting, the contrast between those two roles that that one woman takes on.
And I think that was something that women in many cases used to their advantage at that time, because they could take on this, you know, women at that point, obviously in a secondary role in society, needed to be protected. They could take on that that subservient role and kind of retreat back to it after they had lashed out.
Absolutely. And I think that the union really tried to use that at the beginning, because it was believed that the women would get off scot-free. The women wouldn't face the same pressures and violence and arrests that the male strikers would, and so the women were believed that they would get away with more. And for a while they did, until it was very clear that this wasn't a one-time thing, the women were going to be there every day, and then that's when the women started to pay the consequences for being out there.
Yeah, because Annie Clements spent time in the local jail. Other women also spent time in the local jail for their activities.
Yeah, Annie probably served more than most just because she was on the front, but there's one of my favorite instances in the strike is Annie and a bunch of women get arrested, and they're in jail, and they report to the Miners Bulletin, the union publication afterwards, that they had such a great time in jail, that they were singing and just being together, but that they would have to bring snacks next time because the jailers were so stingy, they wouldn't even give the women a drop of water.
Not very nice. Good heavens.
Not very nice, but I think it shows, you know, that the women weren't as fazed as maybe they could have been or should have been, because they were like, this is important to us. We're going to be out here. And our morale isn't shaken by being in jail.
What do you suppose propelled them into this role? Because this was something that I'm sure many of them were not familiar with and perhaps not even comfortable with as they had grown up, as they had become adults. They weren't taking leadership roles in society. What propelled them to the forefront here?
I have to give credit where credit's due. Annie was a big factor in that. You know, she was part of the Slovenian Nationalist Society, and when she joined it, women weren't allowed in leadership roles, and it was her consistent pushing that ended up allowing women to finally be in leadership roles, which Annie herself entered. And I think she brought that mentality with her when she formed the Women's Auxiliary Group. And, you know, if we look at immigrant societies, the women stick together. And so I think it was really Annie took this step and the women just followed her. And so I think when she transitioned from, you know, the Slovenian group into starting the Women's Auxiliary of the Western Federation of Miners, a lot of those women followed Annie into the Women's Auxiliary.
Talking with Allie Penn, who is a grad student at Wayne State University and doing research into the role of women during the 1913-1914 copper strike here in the copper country. Annie Clements, of course, kind of took the leadership role in all of this, the big flag, and of course, her own stature, her personal stature at 6'2" tall. What propelled her out in front of those parades?
You know, at the beginning, she wasn't, because I think they put the men first, but the men weren't getting nearly as much attention. I mean, she, like you said, she was 6 foot tall. She was carrying this gigantic flag. It just grew attention. I mean, in the press outside of the Keweenaw started to refer to her as Joan of Arc and gave her all these titles. And I think it was the fuel behind that helped propel her to the front, but just her own personal belief in the strike effort pushed her to the front.
And 6'2" is tall for a woman now, but 100-plus years ago, most men weren't over about 5'10", so she would have been a remarkable physical figure.
Oh, 100%. And I think that what's amazing about her is it's not just her physical stature, but if you look at what she's doing within the Miners Bulletin, it's incredible to just see her constant presence in everything.
And she, of course, had a difficult social life. She was married to a miner here. That was not a good relationship, though, was it?
Unfortunately, it was not. There's a lot of speculation that she was mistreated by her husband. She actually files for divorce, you know, in the late winter, early spring of 1914 after the strike, based on claims of, you know, abuse and being abandoned by her husband.
Well, and she had, by all accounts, started an affair with one of the strike organizers who had come into the area during the strike. So the marriage wasn't good even at that point.
Oh, no. I mean, and, you know, just doing the date of birth calculations for when her daughter, like her only child, Darlena, was born in the summer, they definitely had something going on during the strike. So,
yeah, and unfortunately for her, that relationship, she eventually married that gentleman, but that didn't work out. And she actually had a third marriage once she moved out of the Copper Country down to the Chicago area, and that didn't work out either. So not a real happy social life for Annie Clements, but she made such a significant mark on the strike here in the Copper Country that we remember her to this day. And not just a mark, I guess, here, but that's something, do you think, that reverberated to other labor issues and opportunities across the nation?
Absolutely. I think Annie, when she left the strike district in January of 1914 to go, you know, raise morale and, you know, in the wake of the Italian Hall disaster, she went to different strike areas to, you know, generate support. And people recognized her and were excited to see her because the story of Big Annie of the copper mines had spread across the nation. I mean, there's one instance where Ella Reeve Bloor, who is a labor journalist and a labor leader, said that she took Annie to Chicago and she lost Annie for a brief second. And when she finally found Annie, Annie was on strike with the waitresses of Chicago. Even though she was not from Chicago, she was just visiting. She had found the women and joined their cause.
Yeah, so she was on the line. I remember that story.
Yeah.
And that brings me to a couple of other women that I wanted to touch base with you on and see what your reaction was to their presence here. Both of them were national labor leaders. Both of them used the term mother. One was a veteran, and she was in her 70s when she came here early in the strike, and that was Mother Jones, the nationally known labor leader. She came here, and she had a big influence.
Yes. People were very, very excited to see Mother Jones. I mean, her, you know, she was in the West Virginia coal mines, and she was a very big deal. And, you know, within the newspapers, as I'm sure you noticed, people were very excited to see her. They followed her all over the Copper Country. And there's actually like an interesting story where she came in the mid-1900s to evaluate if the strikers were ready, like if the mines were ready to be unionized. And she was like, no, they're not ready. And so it's very poetic that when they were ready and they were on strike, she came back to join their cause and to support them.
Yeah, and she was in her 70s at that point and I think had recently been in prison in Virginia, West Virginia, I think, because of some activities that she had been involved with the coal mine strikes there. So her health was not good, but she must have felt very strongly about this to come under those circumstances.
Oh, yes. I think that she really did, and she was the secret weapon to a lot of the strikes held by the miners. Is they recognized her, they realized how important she was, and she was willing to suffer alongside the men and be, you know, on the front lines.
And I wonder how much impetus her presence here gave to the local women to step up and take on that activist role that they did.
I think it was incredibly impactful to see, you know, a woman, like you said, who's much older, who's been doing this a long time, be there along with them. I think that that must have just reverberated to some of the women maybe who were on the fence, but to the women who, you know, were there every day were probably feeling like this is the right path.
The other mother who came to this area is someone you just mentioned, Ella Reeve Bloor, who was, if Mother Jones was a labor activist, my impression at least of Mother Bloor, Ella Reeve Bloor, is that she was more of a political activist, very active in the Socialist and American Communist parties. She came here and was here later in the strike, but for a longer period of time. She probably was more radical than Mother Jones. What influence did you see from her?
Ella Reeve Bloor spent a lot of time with the Women's Auxiliary. She spent a lot of time, we know, with Annie Clemenc. And I think that you can see that in the way that the women kept persisting. You know, we have a number from Ella Reeve Bloor that we don't have anywhere else about the estimate of how many women were involved in the Women's Auxiliary. And I think that she kept really detailed notes, but I think she just saw how important her presence could be to the women here, and she just decided to stay.
My impression about Mother Bloor, and correct me if you're wrong, because my knowledge of her is superficial, but my impression was that she, I'm sure, had some good in her heart about all of this, but she also used this as kind of a springboard for her own promotional desires. There was a selfishness about her. She was the one who took Annie Clements out on the PR tour. The PR tour did not go well. They abandoned it midway through. Annie came back home. They weren't raising any money to help support the cause. I just got the impression that Mother Bloor was a bit more of a political opportunist than Mother Jones.
Well, I think I would say Mother Jones was a miner, and she was a miner's, you know, a woman of the mining community first and an organizer second. Whereas I would say Mother Bloor, Ella Reeve Bloor, was an organizer and a politician first. And then, you know, she jumped her, and then like a labor activist second. So I think she went from strike to strike organizing because that's what she did. Whereas Mother Jones herself knew the struggle of a miner. And that's why, like, I think maybe she reverberated more. Whereas Ella Reeve Bloor, the union needed her because of her organizing skills. Yeah, so I think it was a little bit of both.
Because a lot of what she left, the things that are included in her autobiography, for example, some of that information about the Calumet strike was a little overblown. Some of it made its way into Woody Guthrie's song, the 1913 Massacre song. There's some incorrect information from there, but it came from Ella Bloor. And I just kind of always got the impression that, I guess my feeling about her was, the situation here was dramatic enough, it didn't need enhancing.
I think that she's a product of a generation to a certain degree, and I think that we have to take her autobiography with a grain of salt, because I when I read it, I feel more like she's trying to sell books, but I don't know for a fact, but I agree with you 100% that a lot of the things are overblown and out of proportion.
Well, and your point,
we have to work with what we have.
And your point is well taken, too, because that was still the era of yellow journalism. Newspapers were doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Talk to me about some of the other women whom you may have uncovered in all of your research. And again, we're talking with Allie Penn, who is researching the role of women in the 1913 copper strike as a grad student at Wayne State University. My deep dive didn't go deep enough to really uncover a lot of other women who took on active roles. I'm sure that there were many. Were you able to find others who took some time in the spotlight there?
Oddly enough, the main resource I have used to identify other women is the coroner's inquest of the Italian Hall disaster, because there were several instances where women were introduced and it said she's a member of the WFM as the part of the Women's Auxiliary, or she was at the Italian Hall for the Women's Auxiliary. And so it's within there that I've plucked out a couple of women and sort of followed them. Now there's one, you know, who some of them, and this is another case of genealogy work, is some of them we couldn't find, and I'm fortunate to have a great researcher who I work with, Lynette Weber, who's at the Keweenaw National Park, and we work together. But, you know, she's tried to find some of the women. I've tried to find some of the women. I've had luck with one of them, Anna Wokala, who she was part of the Women's Auxiliary, and she and her family actually leave the Keweenaw after the strike, and she moved down to Detroit. Her relative takes a job in the auto industry, and she passes away in the 1940s. There's another woman, Minnie Lustig, who is part of the Women's Auxiliary, but, you know, we sort of lose track of her. And I think that there's lots of these women whose names we can find, but then trying to follow them can be problematic sometimes. And the real tragedy to me is that we have a lot of great resources, but that the records that were so dutifully kept by the Women's Auxiliary just haven't survived, or we haven't found them yet. I would love for them to be in someone's basement somewhere, but we just don't know.
Yeah, good luck with that. Well, and it's not as if people were sitting around in 1913 saying, oh, you know, we have to document this really well because a century from now, people are going to be interested.
I'm sure that they had no concept. And I think another thing that if you study women's history or you look into an event about women long enough, records of women were not thought as important and were not kept as much as the records of men. And I think that that's just a problem of, you know, gender dynamics in the past that causes us issues today.
The other challenge that I faced, one of the many challenges I faced when I was doing my research a decade ago, was that it was difficult to find a lot of local reports about what was going on the miners' side that I could read. I mean, I could get the old Mining Gazette records, the Calumet News, those papers are online. I could review those, but of course the newspaper editors were in the pockets of the mine bosses. So that was always very slanted towards the union, towards the mine side of things. The papers that were more on the side of labor, on the side of the miners, were printed in foreign languages. Tumies, the Finnish language newspaper, there was a Croatian language newspaper and an Italian language newspaper. Even if I could find those records, I can't read them.
Right.
So it was tough for me to find the other side as reported locally. I was, however, just really stunned to find out how much national reporting came from here, and particularly some of the pro-union, pro-labor newspapers, almost socialist, again, style newspapers. The New York Daily Call had a bunch of stuff in it. Newspapers in Chicago and Milwaukee. This was a really widely reported event, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that it's important to remember that they had a lot of newspapers on the ground, not just the local ones. And so when you look at them, you have to read into it to see, were they on the ground or are they reprinting from somebody else? But if you find them, like you've noted, there are a lot that were on the ground. So you can actually take that as what is actually happening, because they were actually there and they were actually talking to workers and they were actually participating in union events. And I think that that's really interesting to see, that we maybe haven't kept it really close to the area, but they exist. It's just about finding them.
Yeah, Google is very helpful in that.
Absolutely.
What is the long-term effect of this involvement by women? My impression, again, is that perhaps this was the most involved that a group of women had gotten in one of the significant strikes in the nation. Did this set a precedent for other strikes and other labor issues that developed in future years?
I think that it's really great in that these women are doing this work before they even have like the inkling that they're going to get the right to vote. And I think that that's really interesting, is they don't have really anything and they're still out there, and they're not going to get a vote at the end of the strike, but they're still out there. They're not doing this, but they're still out there. And they're really the backbone of all of this effort. And I think that the women of the Copper Country really inspire women in other areas. You know, there's the Bread and Roses strike over in Lawrence, which is happening, you know, sort of around the same time that this is happening. It happened like the year prior. And the women are really taking the lead there because it's the textile industry and the women are actually the workers. But I think that the women leading in the Copper Country says to women in other mining districts, you know, you have a role you can play if you choose to play it. And I think that that was a really important message.
Allie Penn, what are you going to do with all this research once you've gotten to a point?
So the long-term goal for this is to build a digital story map of the women I use, the Calumet News, the Daily Mining Gazette of Houghton, and the Miners Bulletin, which was the union newspaper. And it's just to track where the women were every day. Ideally, you know, as you've, Todd, have mentioned several times, there's lots of content and more than enough for every day to have several entries. And so right now the decision is, do I do several entries for each day or do I just pick one? But ideally it's to build a story map so people, wherever they are, can look and really feel the impact of these women in the 1913-1914 Keweenaw Copper Strike.
Well, they certainly were groundbreakers. And Allie Penn, thank you so much for your insights. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.